Welcome to Occult of Personality at occultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Occult of Personality, esoteric podcast extraordinaire. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and you can find our website at occultofpersonality.net, featuring an extensive archive of recorded interviews. Occult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the Occult of Personality membership section. Membership provides access to a tremendous archive of interviews for a low monthly fee while helping to support the production and distribution of the show. Please consider subscribing if you haven't already. This episode is also made possible by additional donations from Steve and Lance. Thanks again. Occult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. Now, in episode number 143, our guest is Robert Podgursky, author of Sacred Alignments and the Dark Side of Sigils, published by Mandrake Press Limited. You can find Robert's website at gridmagic.com. That's gridmagic with a K, .com. Robert Podgursky has been researching and working with the Enochian system, the techniques of Austin Osman Spare, and other forms of magical practice for over 30 years, and has published a number of essays on magic and the occult, as well as his own poetry. He's also conducted lectures and workshops throughout the United States. Robert's book, The Sacred Alignments and Dark Side of Sigils, introduces the reader to the grid sigil, an original and innovative magical tool that's designed not only to focus and empower internalized workings, but also to play an active part in external applications such as dowsing and elemental workings. The Sacred Alignments of the title explores the pathways that exist between the grid sigil and other forms of magic, principally Enochian, but also those of Crowley, Spare, Burdio, and others. In addition to providing a practical exposition of sigil magic, the Sacred Alignments offers a scholarly exploration of its diverse roots and inspirations. From the medieval Western concepts of the divine signature to Eastern antecedents such as tantric philosophies of yantra and mandala. The work is illustrated with black and white color plates, including a number by Linda Filorio, and also serves as a celebration of magic as an artful endeavor. Robert's book is perhaps the most original and innovative magical text that I've encountered in some time. It's clear that he spent decades working on the material and has delivered something truly worthy of your attention. Both the contents and the physical book itself are really impressive. The depth of his work, philosophically and practically, is also very impressive, and I highly recommend it. Bob Podgursky, I want to welcome you to Occult of Personality podcast. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for taking some time to join us this evening.
Thanks. It's great to be on the show.
So tonight we're going to talk primarily about your new book, The Sacred Alignments and the Dark Side of Sigils, which is published by Mandrake Press. Is that correct?
Yes, Mandrake Press Limited, not to be confused with Mandrake of Oxford.
That's why I wanted to clarify. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, too many Mandrakes, yeah. I made that mistake early on, and I was chastised for it.
Yes,
rightfully so.
I want to be accurate on that one. And I'll make sure to include links to purchase the book or find information about it from your website and the Mandrake website as well.
Yeah, in the U.S., it's you know, the easiest point of access is going to be Keith Richmond up at, you know, Weiser Books. You know,
excellent. Okay, great.
Yeah.
So to get started, could you tell us how you became interested in esoteric study and practice and maybe some of your early influences?
Well, I'll try to encapsulate it because I could go on and on and on about it. Started pretty early in childhood. I remember having these very odd experiences with sleep, not necessarily so dreams, but just sleep where I would wake up in the morning and felt like I couldn't believe I actually made it back home. Very odd sensation, you know, very, very strange feeling. And that accompanied me for years. And it's interesting because the way I came up with the grid sigil was through exploring lucid states of consciousness into swapna, into deep, you know, delta wave sleep. And I was also interested in supernatural and horror and monsters. I was fascinated with all that. And from an early age, I was kind of hyperactive and very obsessive. And as time went on, I came to realize that the power of obsession was something that was worth harnessing. It was very a useful energy instead of an annoyance. And when I was a teenager, oftentimes going to sleep at night, I would see colors, I would see auras around me, which I thought was very strange until I had a teacher in high school actually talk about it. I said, okay, good, I'm glad I know what that is. I'm not losing my marbles. And then as an undergraduate at Pitt at Greensburg, in an early psychology class, because I had majored in psychology as an undergraduate, went to, on to major in literature in graduate school later on at the University of Colorado. But at Pitt, in the one class, we had, there was the obligatory chapter in Psych 101 about parapsychology. And Nancy Washington, the professor, had a local psychic, Nora, come in. And I became very interested at that point. I was fascinated with it. But after working a little bit in the realms of spiritualism and that, I just felt like not that something so much was lacking, but there was that the safeguards, that the focal points provided by traditional types of magic with banishing methods and things like that were lacking, and that there were potential problems that could crop up in that approach. And then when I discovered Crowley, the Kabbalah, and that, I went hog wild. I said, okay, this is what I want to spend my, because it wasn't only just the practice, but the history, the milieu, the background, everything connected with it, I just found extremely interesting and fascinating and became obsessed with it, more or less. So those are the early beginnings. That's sort of what led me to take that route. And then as I began to work more and more with the Enochian system of magic, and I had the benefit in my undergraduate years of having the time to kick back and really take the route of, John St. John, the sort of the hermit, the super disciplined, you know, more dawn ritual, one at noon in the evening, hatha yoga. I went at it full force constantly, lived, ate, breathed, and drank it. And so I was very fortunate to be able to invest that amount of time.
Yeah. Yeah, many people don't ever get to that point where they're able to commit like that.
Yes. Yeah, so at least I was able to make good use of the time instead of spending it on studying. but nonetheless, the fruits of it did pay off.
So to get to the heart of the subject, how did you come to be aware of the Grid Sigil and its implications? And as you're describing that, you know, maybe you can tell us a little bit more of how you would encapsulate the meaning of what the Grid Sigil is itself.
Okay. Well, the Grid Sigil, I actually more or less earthed, found it materialized, presented to me in July 17th, 1981. In the wake of these very disciplined operations within yoga, traditional magic, lesser ritual, the banishing ritual, the pentagram, very basic rituals, but constant work at it. And the payoff began to occur, that the veils began to lift when I spent more and more time working on gaining awareness within the sleep state. The dreams became more vivid, the images, the visions, as it were. And then on that day, I was, when I woke up in the morning, I was actually able to recall from fleeting glimpses within the deep sleep state that I had perceived this sigil of sorts, which is basically, when you look at the image, you see the cross with the four symbols, the omega corresponding to fire, the root forces of fire, the omicron to the root forces of air, the alpha quadrant to root forces of water, and the tau, the figure resembling a tau. These images are basically resemblances of these Greek letters, the tau corresponding to earth. But then I noticed then that you have the three rays coming through the center. And when you look at the image after a while, you begin to see that that cross and those figures are suspended within it, and that those rays seem to form a sphere or circle without any circumference as you gaze upon it. So it's the interesting thing about it. I became aware fairly early that it was something that just within its own visual qualities, outside of any esoteric meanings attributed to it, actually had something extra sensory to it.
Mm-hmm.
And right off the bat, I sort of knew that I probably was onto something, because I have zero graphic arts capabilities. I've drawn, I've done automatic drawings, I fooled around with that, sketching.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never, ever produced anything along those lines. And I've had a few graphic artists tell me that they found it quite interesting. And I said, yeah, so did I, because I have not a clue what goes into that process of mechanical drawing or graphic art. So on a very basic level there, I began to intuit, okay, there's something a little bit more to it than just the normal dream vision. And then there's really no easy way to answer. We're talking about a good span of 25 years of sitting back with it, of revisiting it through meditation, through the practice of the soldier and the hunchback, of every time I would come up with something, I would just question. I would go back to meditation.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing that would arise, then I would then question that and go back again and keep working with it and getting to the point where I would allow it to speak to me rather than try to pry into it. As I was reading in this fairly interesting, and I don't know why I've gotten into detective novels in later years, but I'd been reading Joe Nesbo's books, his aberrational detective, Harry Hole, makes a great statement. He says the problem with most detectives is they're looking for something, whereas they need to just be looking.
Mm.
And and that's basically what I just came upon on my own. I was like, okay, I'm looking for something. I'm seeing there's got to be deeper meaning to this, rather than just allowing it to be, just to sit and be with it and to see what generates from it spontaneously.
A little bit more of a passive stance.
Yes.
And at this point, I just want to urge people listening to this, if you're not on the website, to look at the graphics, the graphical representation of the sigil, because I think it will be a little bit easier to follow the conversation having seen it and familiarizing yourself with its structure. So this process of you discovering the sigil and then sort of unfolding its implications and meaning, it was obviously I guess you could call it a life's work.
Yes, more or less. And, you know, initially, and I talk about it at great length in the book, I came up with the initial grid sigil and then the second sigil, which I have termed the Aeonic sigils, corresponding the grid sigil to the first Enochian call, the Aeonic sigil to the second Enochian call. Basically, these are sigilic representations of the Enochian calls, and then the ones that correspond to the other, following 16 elements, sub-elements. But with time, my entire outlook upon the calls and what they represented changed drastically, because as I looked at them in the initial interpretation, going from the basic Golden Dawn and looking at them as being the elements and the sub-elements, I came to question that a good bit. And not just my input, but having handed this over to other people to work with. So I've had a few people say they've actually sat down with the sigils and worked with them outside of the context of the Enochian system completely. And so, which is fairly interesting and fairly telling, because then I realized that these sigils were acting as, more or less, as I had used the term in the book, a mesocosmic link, an intermediary nexus point linking the celestial or magical terrestrial type forces, linking it to the microcosmic sphere of the magician and practitioner.
Now, some Enochian aficionados and practitioners ascribe meaning to the entire system, and that it's somehow bound within time and space, and the effectiveness of Enochian in general is relative to the time we live in, or maybe the position of the Earth and the planets and the stars. And I'm just wondering if you had any feeling or opinion about that based on the sigil itself. I mean, and the reason I ask this question is because you sort of found or were able to discover this sigil so many years kind of after the formulation of the Enochian system itself. And I'm just wondering if there's some significance to the timing of this.
Without a doubt, timing's everything here. And speaking of time, one of my initial perceptions of it, that it had to do with emanations, with colic emanations, because you're dealing with the elements as they are bound within time and space. Mm. And just on a purely intuitive level, I mean, you look at the calls you have, the English version, which is very, you know, biblical and apocalyptic in its references. Then you have, and when you look at the Enochian, and I think there's a link between the two. I'm not saying they're divorced from one another, but and then when you read the Enochian in and of itself, outside, it has a very, you know, it's that powerful, sonorous effect.
Yeah.
And the Enochian is a mantra as itself. My initial intuition that these calls activate various nadis within the magician's sphere, mm-hmm. thus linking them up to these higher sources of emanations or assemblage points, to use Castaneda's
language.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot to it. No, I don't think that's missing the boat at all. And in fact, on the Enochian group on Yahoo recently, some people have made some very astute observations stating that they don't agree with the four tablets being necessarily elemental, but having to do with alchemical processes. And that makes quite a bit of sense. Okay.
Yeah.
I think that makes quite a bit of sense. I think it was initially easy to ascribe elemental attributes because it's very basic and it works within sort of that hermetic superstructure.
Right.
But as you step back from it, you work with it. It's one thing, you know, it's one thing to go with the pure explication analysis of it within a certain given context or epistemology, but it's a very different animal within the realm of actual praxis and application. Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, before we go too far down that road, maybe it'd be a good point to try to talk a little bit about how the grid sigil fits into the larger context of Western esotericism historically, because I feel like that may be a good sort of foundation before we get into a little bit more of the esoteric explorations.
Oh, definitely. And I'm glad you brought that up, because when I was thinking about this interview, I was initially thinking about having spent so many years on this project, revision, editing, everything that went into it, and how easy it is to be somewhat complacent with something that you spent so many years on. Say, okay, well, that's it. I put everything I've got into it, and that's all she wrote. Then as I thought about the interview and the purpose of the interview, I thought to myself, the most important thing I can do at this point, and any writer can do with magical text, is to go back and to reassess things. And what caused me to read, it wasn't just this interview. It's funny, I was sitting back and I was reading Michel Foucault's The Order of Things. I don't know if you're familiar with the book. The French is Les Choses, which is actually of words and things, not the order of things, but of words and things. And as I was reading that, and when I first read it, I didn't particularly like it, but having gone back to reread it, there was an awful lot in it that began to click, and it began to click in context of what I had discovered myself in considering the history of the background and the esoteric tradition within sigils. And what came to mind with it was that, well, Foucault talks about the fact that during the 16th century, something, you know, very important happened at that point. He develops this idea, and I won't go into much detail, but he talks about the episteme, this term that basically means, he's talking about the epistemological field surrounding a given time or era that goes into informing, setting up the foundation, the intellectual, the cultural, everything that surrounds a certain, you know, a specific epoch or what have you. But he talks about the 16th century, and he talks about the important thing about that era is that within the language itself was not seen to be an arbitrary thing. Language was something that was connected with the divine signature. Very much out of this logocentric thing, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. So, when they read the Bible within that context, as opposed to ex nihilo, God spoke, that creation, that manifestation occurs by God's issuance through speech, and so man's speech actually can imitate it. That man's speech is imbued with things with this divine signature, so that certain words. So that, you know, certain phrases or things of a plant or an animal are imbued with this astrological, this planetary energy that is not just a hollow symbol or signifier, but it actually possesses that essence of the thing it's signifying. And so as I thought about that, I thought, okay, this is really important because, so when you look at the history of sigils, it's very interesting because for the most part throughout the Middle Ages, and I'm not going to go much further back because you could, you know, you could go the whole way back to, you know, classical period in the Egyptians and such. But I think within the context of the book, it's best to start there because the Enochian system D. And when you look at sigils, what's the thing that, you know, is predominating throughout the Middle Ages is that there's this whole background system of validating that they're magical squares derived out of the Arabic system, mm-hmm. and squares have numbers assigned to letters, and that there's a mathesis, there is a geometrizing underpinning foundation that sets up the structure for the construction of these sigils. And Carl Anton Nowotny has a great article about Agrippa's sigils. And when you read it carefully, it's still somewhat opaque. It's still not very easy.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Specifically, what the origin of this system is.
Okay, yeah, say, yeah.
Okay, you've got the magical square, you've got the numbers and the angel drop, you know, the specific diamond or planetary intelligence is connecting those numbers, and then you get your sigil from. But it's not saying, okay, here's where it originated, here's where the point of inception occurred, et cetera, et cetera. It's all this is taken for granted. And that made me and Foucault makes a great statement. He talks about that within that Renaissance, that Renaissance of classical thought, that there was an unstable mixture of rational knowledge and the metaphysical and magical that was coeval with the institution of God and the church. And we're still obviously working within and working outside of that framework to this very day, mm-hmm. obviously, as practitioners. And so when I thought about that, it's very interesting because, you know, within the framework of God, because so these sigils, okay, you have the mathematical, you have the Pythagorean basis, then there's always that heavy Judeo-Christian overtone because the use of Hebrew, Hebraic scripture, mm-hmm. Usually underpinning. You look through deeds, you look through all the diaries, all the seances begin with these lengthy supplications to God, recitations of psalms. It's just, it's incessant because that was the world that Dee and Kelly had worked out of. And speaking of that, there's one section, it's out of the true and faithful relation that's really worth thinking about because, you know, when we look at that and magical practitioners look at the Enochian system, I think everybody's bearing down on the calls. They're looking at the setup of the magical tables and such. And it's easy, and it was easy for me for years to disregard just some of the basic things that were being communicated, the fundamental things. And there's that one point it's Gabriel's telling Dee and Kelly, there are two kinds of visions, the one by infusion of will and descending, the other by infusion of permission and ascending. The first is the image of the will of God descending into the body and adjoined to the soul of man, whose nature is to distinguish things of his own likeness. But shut up in prison in the body, wanteth that power, and therefore being illuminated by spiritual presence inwardly, seeth now in part, as he shall hereafter do in the whole. But not that every vision is according to the soul of man in power, and so is received of him that seeth. The body of man feeleth nothing spiritual until he be of incorruption, therefore useth no sense in an illumination, the others to be found out by his contrary. And as I thought about that statement, a few things became clear. Most of the Grimers of the period, and Dee and Kelly, as I said, there's that heavy Christian, Judeo-Christian influence, that the rituals and everything are always set up in conformity with that.
Mm-hmm.
correct?
Yeah.
And then, as I said, as you read the Enochian Calls, if you just read the English version and you didn't know much about magic, you would swear you were reading something out of the Apocalypse of John.
Right.
And John. Yeah. And then, so going along those lines and within a traditional, Christian mystic approach, you would say, okay, all this is fitting together. All this is cohering in a logical manner within a doctrinally, set up system within a Christian basis.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing about that section of the book, it's coming from an angel to Dean Kelly through Kelly's reception of it. But the point, and I think this is where magical texts of importance shine out, because you're getting a message in here that this message from the angel is basically telling Dean Kelly, here's where visions come from. God's involved with it, however, not necessarily. This is the greater. There's an interaction between the two.
Yeah.
Okay. There's an interaction between the two, and that perception and awareness of this process, it is a key factor. So it actually stands back and it looks at itself.
Right.
It comes back, and Gabriel gives this snippet of information, which is actually, it's shedding light. It's a moment of illumination that is separate but contained within the system. And I think that's really important, and that's key, because Dee and Kelly, you wonder how much they actually paid attention to that statement, And I wonder how many people, because when you think about it carefully, then Gabriel's basically saying, okay, you've got the Enochian calls, they've been interpreted, but that interpretation is possibly due to the path of this vision. So the angel, for lack of better words, is basically letting them know that this is something that you need to deconstruct. This is something that you need to disassemble, reassemble, and you need to follow the path with as greatest amount of clarity of vision as possible, so that you know what's being picked up from where, how much of it is actually a true inspiration from above, and how much of it is input from your own background. And it's interesting, because I like, what is it, I said that every vision is according to the soul of man in power, and so is receiving the seed. The body of man feeleth nothing spiritual until he be of incorruption. So when you really think about it, it's like he's basically telling Dean Kelly, well, guess what? You can forget it. Answers, the visions are always going to be tanked.
Yeah, I mean, I could be missing some of it, but it almost sounds a lot like that whole idea of until the temple is consecrated and prepared, the spirit will not indwell within it. And
yeah,
giving
Gabriel's
him that
also saying, it's also funny because he pulls the rug out from under and it's like, that's never going to happen. There's always going to be some sort of corruption. There's always going to be, something tanking the process. So you can forget it. I mean, you can read it that way.
yeah, you could read it that way. It's interesting, too, if you kind of like step back from it and think about Gabriel and his many famous appearances in Western religion. The one that comes to mind specifically, because we're talking about corruption in the body,
mm-hmm.
is Muhammad's night journey.
Yes.
The prophet of Islam, before he was sent on this night journey, the angel Gabriel basically took out his insides and washed them, or is that's the way the text reads?
Yes,
anyway.
Yes, I remember that. I remember that.
So it sounds familiar. I'm not really sure if D was familiar with that. It wouldn't surprise me if he was. But
you know what? Since you brought that up, it does bring one thing to mind that D would have been familiar with. There was the idea that was tossed around within theological studies and circles within the Renaissance, talking about the fall of man, that when the fall from grace occurred in the Garden of Eden, that nature itself fell. Okay? So if man is a part of nature and man falls, then one can infer that nature itself has become corrupt in this fall.
Hmm.
So nothing's safe, nothing's pure.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective.
Yeah, there is doubt. And you know, coming back to Foucault, he made another interesting observation. I like what he brought up. He was talking about in Words and Things, the idea about, and I'm glad he did because I hadn't thought about it carefully for a while either, the idea of microcosm, macrocosm, you know, the microcosm being a reflection of the macrocosm.
Mm-hmm.
And what we so easily overlook that it really is just a general configuration when you think about it, that it's mere surface effect, because who in the Renaissance said, okay, well, now we've got to sit down, the Academy's got to sit down, and we've got to find the connection between everything in the macrocosm and the microcosm. We've got to work this out from beginning to end. It wasn't done.
Right.
It becomes an issue of philosophical speculation, which has carried us on to today.
Right.
Obviously, it's an important one. It's one that will never end. It's involves so many people. The biggest example in modern times is science. You look at the case of Wolfgang Pauli and Jung, where Pauli experienced great depression and such. You know, he was a Nobel Prize winner in quantum physics. Depression and nothing would lift. He started working with Jung and working with mandalas and such. That, okay, this is what's missing. There's this alchemical element which is connected to the dream state, which is connected to the physical world. And now I'm beginning to see, I'm being able to unravel things through this intuitive process, which is connected to an ancient antecedent to modern physics. And so, yes, as I thought about that, it's because when you look at sigils and you look at how they're developed, during that period, you have one thing, you see this point of illumination within Agrippa's work too, because in book 3 of the De Occulta Philosophiae, Agrippa actually, he cites the example which spared, caught on to is the sigil for Michael, just taking Mikhail, the angels, taking the letters and sticking them together mm-hmm. to make a sigil.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting because I always wondered, I would like to have known, where did Agrippa pick that up? Because he doesn't get, there's no Pythagorean geometrizing underpinning to it.
Right, like you have it's with many of these other things.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like anybody can do this, just pull out a word and whip it together. But then again, it's interesting because the example that he put, he didn't power or creation or money, it's a name of an archangel. So it's still that onto theological overriding influence affecting his choice. I don't think it's an arbitrary choice.
No, I don't either. I mean, I don't know, but I would speculate that the abbot of Trithemius probably taught him that, and it was maybe
possible.
You know, magical, yes, but also a way of hiding information, or encoding, maybe a better term. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that one, you know, I can see that with a lot of other stuff, but that's that specific example of the De Occulta, it's a simple, straightforward thing.
Yeah.
You know, using the number, corresponding numbers, letters, patterns, sure, it fits in to that cryptographical element, you know, with Trithemius.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one wonder, it's very difficult. It's almost like an Eastern influence. Maybe it's something that came in from the Nestorians, you know, as they were bringing Arabic thought and whatnot out of the East. It's not really something you see in the Picatrix, so I don't think Alfonso, you know, I don't think there's the connection there. It's a very curious thing, but I'm bringing up because, again, like the statement of the, you know, that example from the True and Faithful Relation, that this instance from the De Occulta shows that even at that time, there's the precursor, there's that bud of that, you know, spontaneous, of something, you know, do-it-yourself method of sigils, which sort of, more or less presages what Spear is able to eventually grab, Austin Osman Spear is actually able to grab and latch onto and then, you know,
right.
take off with. Yeah.
My sense is that when people think about sigils, they do think of spare, they think of chaos magic.
Mm-hmm.
Some may, you're right, go back to the idea of using a grid or drawing lines to connect letters or numbers to create the character. Or, you know, there's an underlying hidden geometry, which then the sigil is created upon to connect certain points that, mm-hmm. of intersection. But I honestly feel like that is such a in-depth tracing a history of sigils and their use that it's much more comprehensive than most people think of when the topic comes up.
Yeah, I mean, what I was bringing about with Foucault comes into play there. Think about the fact that that simple thing I was talking about, that language was looked at as being directly connected to the signifying object. So what do you have? Sigils are basically a metaphysical type of language. And I think what we're looking at, the object of the magician is to tap into and discover that orthography, that method of signification, which comes closer to manifesting the intended, willful fruition mm-hmm. of the magical wish. And the whole thing, the whole idea of an Adamic tongue, there was an obsession with it. Was it Hebrew? You know, William Postel talks about it quite a bit. Dee was, you know, obviously obsessed with it. In fact, with the Enochian characters, what's at one point when his communication with the angel Ild says something, the letters represent the creation of man. They must be in proportion. They represent the workmanship wherewithal the soul of man was made like unto his creator.
Wait, this gets into a question that I've pondered almost a little too much, which is the genesis of language or languages. Mm-hmm. There are certain idiosyncrasies with words, numerical values, and with gematria, divine names. And at some point, when I look at all of this together, I keep coming back to this question of, was the language development an organic process? Was it constructed intentionally by men, or is there some reception or delivery by some other force, or is it some combination of the two? I have trouble really reconciling when I look at Greek, ancient Greek, even more than the Hebrew, where you have the god names, the math involved with the divine names, and the way they fit together to illustrate geometric principles or metaphysical principles that can be discovered and communicated through numbers. I find it a stretch to say that the language evolved organically and this they just happened to say, oh, Hermes equals this, which is one third of this, and it just happens to work out. You know, I think they chose these names on purpose, but the mm-hmm. fact that it fits together so well, I often wonder, is there something greater at play? And it sounds like your work with sigils and the grid sigil kind of points to a direction that, you know, there is something that for most of us is really imperceptible that's affecting language, speech, the use of language and its implications.
Well, the very question, I think, is what is basically forms the, you know, the whole gist of what we were talking about there. The fact that people, and the answer to it, who knows what it is, but it has generated these attempts at coming up with a sublimated means of communicating with the unseen essences that are the back of the formative world, right?
That is probably the best, most eloquent way I've ever heard that described. So I think you're right.
And so, yeah, to sort of come back to what we're talking about. So in the Middle Ages, yeah, you've got the sigils, you've got these methodologies, you know, very complex ones derived. Then eventually it gives way into, you know, into the time when Austin Spare appears to showing up and developing the individualized sigils that are made outside, isolated within the magician's sphere, without any regard to other previous and outside systems. And maybe it has something to do with the fact that a lot of, you know, there's different views. It's during the, you know, the Renaissance, the individual begins to emerge.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
The group takes a backseat. The individual begins to stand forth. And so man's magic and his approaches to metaphysics are maybe somehow mirroring that. It's a speculum of it. Spare, finally, he gets to that point, and then he develops the ones within, you know, the age, within the rise of modernism, when there's a split with tradition to some extent, and the individual becomes even more isolated, maybe to the point of crisis. And then what I'm suggesting in my books is that with the grid sigil itself, you look at it, it's not just the sigil, it's very recognizable. You see the alpha and omega, it's very much like the Christogram, the Labarum, right, you know, of Constantine. Mm-hmm. And so I think then what I'm suggesting, what I sort of perceived in my system, there's this gray area, there's a point where sigils and symbols sort of meld. And then also the thing is with that grid sigil is it's not just to be used in terms of how Spare described it or as an evocational tool. It's an actual blueprint for an astral model so that you can actually, like, you draw pentagrams about yourself, you set up the grid and create an astral pyramid about yourself. Very much like, and I don't know why it's overlooked as much as you don't hear much talk about it, is the Rose Cross ritual.
Right.
Where you develop the square around yourself. To me, it's almost, it's like a Reichian astral box.
Yeah.
Same thing with the grid. So the grid sigil takes on extra dimensionality, and not just figuratively, but literally in terms of astral formation and figuration. So that's taking the next leap, or at least as insofar as I've been able to just glimpse at how it's working at this stage.
Yeah. Now, I probably should have gone to this question sooner because I think we were kind of at the point where it would have been a really good segue. But
sure.
But you've written in the book that the grid sigil system marks the next stage in the evolution of sigil magic, rather than being derived through ratiocination or verified by mundane logical methodologies. The grid sigil represents a direct mesocosmic link between that which is above and that which is below, conscious and unconscious matter and antimatter. It acts as a nexus point for the universe's fabric. So you had mentioned this earlier in the conversation.
Yes.
To me, this is, it's, well, you say it's the next step, but to me, it's almost like a quantum leap because the the thought processes, the level of thought, I think, that goes into this, you know, its meaning, how it's used, what it represents is, to me, seems like a quantum leap from, you know, Agrippa or even Spare in the use of the way they did this.
Or maybe it's actually just a step back. As you brought that up, I was thinking in particular about the certain Aboriginal tribes in Australia. Thinking in terms of geomatic magnetic, they see the Earth as covered with a grid or lines called dumbun, and they intersect.
Mm-hmm.
And that they had actually developed trails across Australia based on these lines, and that there are songs that pertain to these lines, almost like chants. So that makes me think of the Enochian system almost. And I'm of the opinion there's nothing new under the sun. I think that various seers, primitive cultures have had ways of perceiving the Earth's grid.
Mm-hmm.
The grid sigil just basically provides an tangible visual object that allows one to look into that grid or to detect it.
Mm-hmm.
So what may seem as a quantum leap may not be such a big jump. It may be a jump backwards to an awareness of some earlier process of perception that was at work, because that's one thing I talk about in the book without going into great detail, is that some seers perceive these crossing lines around there. Don Juan talks about it with Juan Tuma, said that there are crisscrossing lines that go about the globe that are fixed. That these cords of power one can hook into. And then basically what I suggest is that the grid can, once you perceive it, you can lock that grid into that intersection point and then actually manipulate it. In figurative terms, Peter Lamborn Wilson's temporary autonomous zone, he comes up with this great idea, talks about the fact of taking, you know, we live within the web of reality.
Mm.
The idea for the temporary autonomous zone magician is to lock into the web and then create their own little isolated autonomous grid within the web. So the terminology being used is somewhat telling, and it fits right in with the magical practice,
mm-hmm.
practice that I'm suggesting here. Yes, you were going to.
Yeah, I have a, this is sort of an aside, and I may edit this out, but I feel like this is the proper point for me to ask it.
Yes.
We're talking about the grids and the intersection points and sort of tapping into the energy or power that intersection point holds. I've been told by laboratory alchemists, not all of them, but one of them in particular that I talked to, he told me that these intersection points on the Earth are crucial to the transmutation of metals. And by harnessing by actually doing the experiment at that point of power, that the alchemist harnesses some additional force that will allow the transmutation to occur. I have no idea how accurate that is, but that's exactly what he told me.
Well, in terms of magical logic, it makes obviously perfect sense. I mean, to use what's at your, you know, fingertips, to use the available forces to hook in. You know, you can do things independent of these forces, or you can try and work in harmony with them and hook up to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it makes, you know, perfect sense along those lines of reasoning.
Okay. All right. Before we talk specifically about the book, I'm just wondering if there's anything else you want to touch on or mention specific to the grid, the context of how it fits into history or its use, or anything else that you want to mention?
Well, there's been, without digressing too much, but as I think about it, there's so many theories proliferated about being able to map out a system of intersecting lines about the globe, and a lot of people use this as a jumping point of Watkins' book about ley lines.
Right.
The old straight track.
Yep.
Which he isn't being specific, but he talks about initial, you know, the basis for that. And then Bruce Cathay, that pilot from New Zealand, developed that extremely elaborate thing, a harmonic 33. And I don't know how much it's exact, but it's certainly amazing in detail.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have drawn lines from the Great Pyramids of Egypt to the Bermuda Triangle, et cetera, and as a result of that, we're able to find that triangle that lies off the coast of Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at, you know, the history of this, you look at the preeminence of notions about it, there's obviously something to it. Without a doubt, I have no doubt about that. And that seers, dowsers, that root doctors that people have tapped into for years, And nowadays, it surfaced itself in feng shui. Huh. I think, and you know, just for the masses approach to it. So it's, I think, with any of these magical theories and concepts of any value, that they work themselves into everyday life and other things outside of our control, which I think is somewhat of an indicator of how, you know, they're operating behind the scenes. And then I'm ready to jump into the book and start trying to describe each part of each chapter. It's going to get a little bit too complicated, I think, but just as my initial reaction to it, I think that's, you know, some of the relevance. And in different cultures have different, if you look at the Greeks, you look at the setup of omphalae throughout Greece, those navels.
Yes.
You look in the East, you look at stupas and how they're set up. That I think there is, that the individuals that set these up were doing it with some sort of heightened awareness of what they're actually doing with the earth, or harnessing into, or interfacing with it. So I think, a very condensed answer, that we can find examples of things that would point towards the perception of this within different cultures and different areas.
Could you tell us how you decided to publish your work on the grid sigil in a book form and really put this out to the magical community?
Well, when I had initially come up with it, I had written up a very rough draft of the whole thing back, and then did a Xerox copy and got it out there and sort of self-published it. And it was pretty rough and pretty ragged. And when I think back, and it's one of those things, and, you know, nowadays it's like people just want to publish stuff too quick. And why don't they take the time? Well, I was guilty of it too. And it's amazing. When I looked on Amazon recently, somebody had a copy of the thing out there. I'm just embarrassed. They have $90 for it. It's like, I want some of that money. but no, actually, I'd rather just be burned. So when I first threw that together, that's what I done. But then I stepped back from it. I went on to do graduate work in English literature, Renaissance literature at University of Colorado at Boulder. I had done a thesis-like project on looking at the Enochian calls as a form of magical poetry. So after I'd done that, I stepped back and began to reassess again background information that went into the book. And then it was a long process of condensation. We're talking a good 15 years of then doing practical applications, working hard at research and such. And then I had, and at that point I was up to about 600 pages, and then I knocked it down to about 400, 300. Chuck Stein, author of Persephone and Veil, was kind enough to help me out in taking the diamond out of the rough. That would have been back in 2005. And then I got it down to, you know, pretty close to the final version, really. It's roughly about 200 pages. And so it sat around. I never had much luck with it. And getting it published, submitting it to the usual channels. And then one day on a lark, after I'd gotten Ben Fernie, Caduceus Books, I got his catalog email, and I thought, well, I should just send it to Ben because he publishes books. And he mentioned to me, he said, well, I can't do anything with it. But he had told me that he and Tony Naylor over at Mandrake were thinking about doing an imprint of Thelemic-type-based books for people that were non-affiliated with the, you know, traditional Thelemic groups, OTOs and such. And then I got it to Tony, and Tony said he found it interesting. And around 2010, and then the real work began. And then it was about 2 years of just painstaking, just hardcore editing and revising. And Tony was just one heck of a taskmaster, which I will be forever grateful for, because he's an extremely careful reader. He's well versed in the D archives and caught many little things which would have been fairly embarrassing had they not been cleared up. And so that's in a nutshell, you know, about how that pretty much came about. And it's interesting. One thing I wanted to bring up, there's only been one review done so far, and Petra Sedrins did this review for Open Space, it's arts magazine out of New York, out of the Red Hook area. And he mentioned, what's a magical book? You would have to scarf it down, breathe it, go back to it, never revise. And explication of the initial initiatory vision, crystalline, that which grabs you palpably. Its justifications, occasionally weighted with pseudo-academic intentions, matter not. And then he quotes Spare, does not matter, need not be. And when he did that, it made me think, he was right in part, but on the other hand, I had to think, see, a lot of times I think people sit down and when they write magical texts and they do a lot of scholarly background legwork, it's sort of justifying.
Yes.
Sort of a justification. It's sort of a, defense of what they've done. And as I thought about it, that's not why I took that approach, because I had to think about Charles Olson, the poet, had this process. We talked about genealogy as a magical process. Looking back in your family's roots can be used as almost like a, you know, sort of a journey back into past lives sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm grossly oversimplifying, but it made me consider the fact that the reason I did the research is I was more concerned with my own interaction and experience of what I consider to be the magical genealogy of the parthenogenesis of this book.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just research for research's sake or being able to flash the well-read erudition, and that wasn't the intention at all. For me, it was an active, okay, as I'm digging this up, this is an active stepping into the field wherein I have experienced things that have brought revelation and greater understanding for my own sake, selfish purposes. And so the reason I bring that up is because when doing this sort of thing, this type of book, I wanted to do something new. I did want to do something hybrid. Doing a lot of scholarly work, the problem always is going to be is waxing academic, and mm-hmm. I wanted to avoid that at all costs.
Well, I think you successfully avoided that, and I know my impressions of the book, particularly what you talked about in terms of the historical background information, I found, just like the rest of the book, totally refreshing. It was both personal and applicable to your work, and yet general to, you know, the history of Western esotericism. It's presented in such a way that it's very readable and scholarly at the same time without being stuffy or inaccessible. I feel like the entire book is so much different than the typical, you know, magical fare that you find. I mean, I've read hundreds, if not thousands, of these type of books, as I'm sure you have. And this one really distinguishes itself from the content as well as the physical book, the way it's presented. And it's, I mean, I'm impressed. And this is, again, part of the reason I wanted to talk with you is because the work has a level of creativity and originality that I just haven't quite seen before.
And that's why I'm glad you feel that way, because that is why it took so long. Because as I thought back on it, and you made a good point, you're talking about the actual content and the appearance. There's that old thing, you know, in Ed Dahlberg's exchange with Olson, came with this idea that form should be an extension of content and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we should all aspire to it.
Yeah, no doubt.
Easy to say, but another thing to do. So that's what I thought. Okay, magic is an art, so that this book should be a work of art as well, if I can help it, if I can manage it. And so finding that blend of scholarly insight and awareness, self-awareness, critical approach in the book, and at the same time dealing with visionary issues and also interjecting with art was that was the whole puzzle of this thing, being able to pull all those factors together into a cohesive, contiguous body, organic thing that would actually work together as a living structural whole. And that's the thing. When you read it, it depends on how you read it. And there are so many ways to pick up a book and read it. But when you look, one thing we're talking about, what's unique about the book, what isn't unique about it is it's got biographical background. I supply historical context. There's illustrations, there's exercises. On the surface and appearance, it's a fairly traditional structuralist piece of work. But in terms of methodology and technique, I think that's what you were picking up on, it's very post-structural. Mm-hmm. Through allusion and inference, because the one thing I was determined to do was not to be ultimately dictatorial and authoritative, that it would be open-ended. Mm-hmm. That to me is the direction, that's what has to happen within the production and composition of magical texts if magical texts are to evolve.
So do you see that sort of as a reflection of, well, I will say just the evolution of humanity? My impression is that your tone and that sort of open-ended style that you've adopted is sort of an evolutionary track. Things are becoming more open, more accessible, and I think you're right that people generally nowadays tend not to be attracted to authoritarianism and dogmatism.
Well, I think it's so much is dependent on the actual root of the whole monograph, and the root being the individual. And in my case, I've had a real problem with manifests, with mandates. Mm-hmm. But by and large, I'll be the first to admit it. Like I said, when you pick the book up, you read it, you may feel that way. It's easy enough to conceive of it in that notion. And to set down anything concretely in a systematic, linear fashion so that we can comprehend it, there's not much of a way around it to an extent. But what's actually implied and asserted, and what I'm trying to allude to, I'm demanding a lot of the reader. I think you've picked up on that too. It's the demands I'm making are that as you read this book, and I even mention it in there, you need to question what it is, the reasons why you read magical texts, what it is that your path actually elicits. And then as you rethink that in turn must by needs modify your means of and methods of reading.
Yeah.
Acquiring information.
I mean, I'll admit to the fact that it took me several reads through to feel like I actually started to get a grasp of what you were talking about and its implications, because, you know, when I read through it the first time, I think I superficially kind of understood what you were getting at, but like I told you before we started the recording, when I tried to explain it to someone else who hadn't read it, I fell flat, because my level of comprehension is not where it needs to be in order to convey that information. And I think it, in addition to sort of challenging the reader and their preconceptions and assumptions, I think it also is challenging in an intellectual sense, not because it's difficult to read, but because the ideas and the concepts you're discussing are to my mind, just more advanced. They may not be more advanced in a chronological, historical sense, but from what I'm used to in terms of magical books, this is more advanced by a long shot.
Thank you. And, you know, it was actually broached with me. One person said, you know, Bob, you really should have sat down and given more basics about Enochian magic. I'm thinking to myself, how many books are there out there already? Do we need one other fucking more basic? It's like, no, I'm not going to do that. It's been done. Okay. It's been done. And if you really want to know that end of it, you go look at that stuff. But you brought up a good point. I mean, it's the thing, intellectually, I think part of the thing that one encounters with this book, it's, you know, it's that old conundrum, the old Pistia Sophia, you know, that faith bolstered by wisdom, by intellectus, is what makes the modern magician go around, right? It's, you know, it's that reason, it's that careful reasoning process, which is supported by an intuitive edge, but honed down carefully through this constant interplay of going back through this, you know, through the background information, through the practical applications, and then being able to reassess it and deal with it as it moves and picks up accretions. I think that's what you were picking up on it in the second read. But at least as you read it over and over again, it became clearer, right?
Absolutely. No, I mean, it felt like an unfolding process where, you know, maybe the first time I read it, I simply wasn't really ready to understand some of these ideas. I mean, like I said, you know, I think it all depends on what you're used to. And I think maybe if somebody's used to, like, you know, advanced philosophy or theology, or they, you know, are simply like extremely intellectual, they could pick this up and see how advanced it is and really get it on the first read. But for somebody like me, it took some work to really penetrate into it. And I'm sure that there's more there that it will reveal as time goes on.
Yeah, there's multi-levels too. But on the same hand, I mean, wouldn't you admit, let's say you just skipped everything and just went to practical applications and here's how to use the grid like a dowsing rod.
Yeah, I could do.
There you go. You got something you can do. You don't even have to look at the rest of this. That was...
Yeah, and I don't want to scare anybody off of the book, but I do want to... I think it's a selling point that it's complex, and I think that all of that information at the front end, for me personally and probably for other people, really brings to life the practical aspects in such a way that while they may work and they may be easy to follow, it brings so much more to the table that like I said, it's a breath of fresh air, and I'm curious. You said there's only been one review so far, but I'm curious some of the other reactions you've gotten to the book.
Well, from my readers, it's all been pretty positive, and I've had some very good readers for it, including, as I said, Chuck Stein, Garrett Lansing. I've had numerous people look at this book. And the reaction has been very similar to yours. I've not had one negative response, but I have had from my friend Linda Florio and Fred Fowler, her lifetime companion. Fred had mentioned, Bob, don't expect to hear much about this back on this because it's a Weltanschauung. It's like a worldview. And, you know, what are people going to say about that? don't expect to hear a whole lot. They might have a very good point. You know, the day and age, but I'd love for someone to sit down and tell me this thing's a piece of crap and here's why, A, B, C, D. You know, but unfortunately, we live in such PC times. It's not like people sit down and engage in the disputation.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I guess you just go to Facebook and say something sucks because it sucks. You know? I don't know.
such is our culture.
the morass that we're falling into.
Yeah, and that was the object too, was that it would, that it's not necessarily the actual, the grid sigils and the prima facie elements, but I wanted to provide people with the actual, my actual thought processes and reasoning and theory that went into it, so that even if you don't find the tools themselves valid, you actually can walk away with an apparatus for developing your own.
That's a very important point. Very important point. But I really appreciated all of that contextual and historical information, and it really, I think, would have been lacking without that, in my opinion. One of the things we haven't mentioned yet, and and I don't want to be negligent here, because I think when people actually see or hold the book, it's going to be blatantly obvious that this book is different physically from most in its size and the way it is put together. It's obviously a standard book, but can you talk a little bit about the physical aspects?
Well, as I was saying before, the idea of form being an extension of content and vice versa, it's, you know, it's a hardbound black 12 by 12. The sigils themselves are done white on black background. And the idea was that I've always felt, and it's interesting, I was very fortunate in that I think so many writers sit there and they fantasize, visualize what they would like to see the, you know, the final version of their book be, but never really think it's going to happen, and it happened for me. So I consider myself extremely fortunate. And as a result, I hope and I feel to some extent that it produced a magical book that itself is a magical implement. Mm-hmm. One can sit down and just gazing meditations with the various grid sigils and such in the back of the book can actually do work straight out of it. And it makes me think, too, it's one of the best things that was ever written about dealing with a magical book is Jan Fries's book, The Cauldron of the Gods, his manual on Celtic magic. Mm-hmm. He does, in the very beginning, he has a little section on how to read magical books, and it's wonderful. It's using it as a magical tool, not just as some implement for intellection. I love it. He talks about you sit with the book. I won't go into much detail because everybody should read it and sort of just fiddle with it, skim through, just, you know, mentally note little sections here, out there, you know, pop into your mind. And then later, hold it up to your head, you know, feel it, use your third eye, all these little extra, you know, to sense what's inside and to actually utilize it as a tool instead of just another repository of information. And it was with that sort of logic in mind is how I constructed the book.
Yeah, it is possibly one of the most unique books that I have in my collection, and just physically it stands apart from any other, and that alone I think is a real accomplishment.
Well, and you can give the kudos to Tony Naylor for that, because when I put it to him, as I said, he made the dream come true, and he locked into it, and he was able to carry that end of it to fruition. You know, he does everything himself. Hmm. He is editor, he's printer, publisher, editor, binder, the whole shebang inside of this renovated barn in the UK. And so it made it, as I said, Tony's a real taskmaster, but actually bringing it to fruition was enjoyable because it wasn't like you had to go through proofs and then go back and forth with the printer and make sure they came out right, because there was no middleman.
Okay.
And so when you have, that's the other thing that adds to what you're feeling and perceiving there, is that the actual producer of the book has a handle on what it means to produce a magical book, because Tony is a bit of a bibliophile. He handles, understands, works with early incunabula, old texts. So there's that feeling that you derive from that, because there has, you know, there's been that loving attention put into it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, looking at the book, holding it, reading it, and even talking with you about it, it really brings to mind the work of Joseph Uccello, who I had on the podcast little while ago, who's a publisher himself, and in his Ocklyth Zero, Volume Zero, he, in the beginning of the book, he talks about how the book is a living being. It's mm-hmm. the body upon opening. It radiates knowledge like a microcosmic sun, inflamed mm-hmm. by the hand, the eye, the mind. There's all these hidden interactions that go on when you engage with the book. Some are apparent to your senses, and others are totally unconscious. This idea of talismanic texts, it's really a proper and apt container for the content of your book.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear it from you because of your... See, I just don't want to play it up. I want people to actually, you know, see it for themselves.
No, it's extremely impressive. Very impressive. The work that went into it, I really can't imagine. The artwork, the layout, the printing, the quality of the book itself is just phenomenal. I can't imagine that this is something that is easy to do. And certainly it doesn't appear like you could mass produce this, nor would you want to.
Yeah. Yeah. A paper, I'd often thought, gee, we should have done a trade paper version, but it is the way it's supposed to be. That would have been an injustice tonight. And for the price, it's we could have charged double.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
for what it's, when you look at what art books go for, that thing could definitely have gone double for what it's going for.
I just would like, if you could quickly remind people where they can find you online.
Oh, well, gridmagic.com, and that's magic spelled with a K. You go to that website or just look up the Sacred Alignments and Dark Side of Sigils on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the Facebook page. I maybe don't update it as much as I should, but be that as it may, that's not a bad one to go to. And as I said, in the U.S., the primary distributor would be Keith Richmond at Weiser Books on the East Coast. On the West Coast, J.D. Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the UK, there's a number of booksellers as well as Mandrake Press Limited. He sells them on his site, and he also sells them on eBay UK as well. You're not going to find them on Amazon because just couldn't afford to cut them that percentage. We'd be going for a loss, as many small presses just can't deal with them for that reason.
Right. Well, what I'd like to do, if it's all right with you, is take a quick break and then come back and go through the rest of the questions and finish up.
Not a bad idea.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bob. In the Occult of Personality membership section, Robert Podgursky delves even deeper into his work on the Grid Sigil, including its connection with Thelema and the Aeon of Horus. A greater appreciation for the origins and significance of language and writing, and much, much more. Join us for that exclusive recording in the Occult of Personality membership section. The membership section helps to support the podcast and provides members with access to well over 100 interviews, meditations, essays, and much more. Just browse to occultofpersonality.net/membership. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.